This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. We are almost halfway through what will be the big year for one Naples, Florida birder. Later in the show, we'll check in with Evie Morrell to see how she's doing in her quest to see 700 species of birds in North America. But first, today is National Chocolate Chip Cookie Day, and what was once a benign indulgence of calories seems to have evolved into a potential gut bomb loaded with allergy triggers. That chocolate chip cookie is loaded with ingredients to which it seems more and more people are sensitive or intolerant. Wheat flour, eggs, butter, chocolate, nuts, even sugar. Any one of those things can cause problems for people, depending on their sensitivity, intolerance, or allergy. Now, food allergies are nothing new, and intolerance to things like lactose have been widely known and accepted for decades. But now food sensitivities are driving people off foods that they once loved in a desperate search for wellness. But how do people identify exactly what is causing their health issues? Some omit a given ingredient and wait and see, but now a new blood test called the ALCAT test is being used by hundreds to screen for 450 individual foods, additives, colorings, and chemical substances. Joining us to talk more about how the ALCAT test works is Roger Deutsch. He's the CEO of Florida-based Cell Science Systems, which is leading the food sensitivity testing industry from our own backyard. Roger, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We are talking about food allergies, food sensitivities, and food intolerance, and a blood test that can determine exactly what it is that ails you. Give us a call with your thoughts at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Mr. Deutsch, you embarked on this project to find the definitive testing for food allergies and sensitivities because of a long battle with your own allergies. Tell me a little about that.
Yes. When I grew up in the 60s as a teenager in the northeast of the U.S., during hay fever season, I had intolerable symptoms. So I went to the local allergy specialist for about 1 year and went every week for shots, and I was also prescribed the first generation of antihistamine drugs. And the shots didn't have any effect, and the drugs were not tolerable. So I decided I would ask the allergist what actually causes allergy. I was pretty perplexed and a little frustrated. And she told me at that time, nobody really knows. So I thought that was an interesting answer. I went off on a quest to try and figure it out on my own.
And then life got in the way, and you went into a different business and then kind of came back to this in the early 80s?
Yeah, well, I did a lot of different things. I traveled the world. I enrolled in the School for Oriental Medicine in the UK in the early 70s because the Chinese ancient medical texts spoke a lot about how the different organs relate to the propensity for allergy. I actually went to India and studied meditation, thinking that, well, maybe I can burn up my allergy karma, and came back and got involved out of necessity in something that would earn a living for me. So I became an oil broker. And with some colleagues, we built the largest oil brokerage company in the world, and it was very lucrative, but it didn't really satisfy or align with my personal ambitions and interests. And so I retired from that quite early on and sought another project. In 1986, I found that there was some research going on at the University of Miami, and a couple of gentlemen who had a small research lab in South Florida. And they had developed the rudiments of a test that could identify adverse reactions to foods. And they achieved this first patent. They were looking for somebody who had the interest but also had the business experience and background to try and make something of that. So I got involved in that project in 1986.
And then it became Cell Science Systems, and as recently as last year, it was recognized as the North American Company of the Year by Frost & Sullivan, and that's a company that's focused on new technologies. And the specific technology that we're talking about today is the ALCAT test, which determines a person's food sensitivities. Well, first, tell me the difference between an allergy and a sensitivity.
Well, there are several differences, and of course, this is all nomenclature. And I'll preface this by saying in 1906, when the term allergy was coined by an Austrian pediatrician named von Perquet, he meant it to denote an altered reaction. But there were broad ranges of altered reactions that were observed, and some would produce acute symptoms, and some were less acute, more chronic, and less well defined. As a convention, the allergists in Europe decided during the period of the 1920s, 1930s, to restrict the definition of allergy to that which was would present with immediate and acute symptom onset. So today, we pretty much adhere to that convention, and to us, allergy, and when it applies to a food, means an immediate and rather dramatic onset of symptoms. So if someone eats crustacean, breaks out in hives, or has exposure to peanut proteins and has an anaphylactic reaction, we call that an allergy. Now, a sensitivity is a different biological pathway. It evolved to deal with different issues, and the symptoms present much more delayed. You can have exposure to a food every single day and have chronic symptoms that come on maybe hours or even a couple of days afterwards. And so you have these symptoms every day, and they're not as acute, they're more vague, and therefore the connection between the ingestion of the food and the onset of the symptoms is not nearly so apparent as it is with a classical food allergy.
It's a little bit harder to identify. And then there's the issue of intolerance. Now, that's another path.
That's right? A nuance, and intolerance is, you know, kind of related, and they overlap a lot with sensitivity. But an intolerance would be where we know there's an enzymatic deficiency. So, for example, lactase is deficient, and so a person cannot tolerate lactose, and they would have irritation. Not necessarily so much of an immunologic reaction, but a kind of an irritation. There's other types of intolerances. People don't recognize these so often, but in the literature today, we see so many, well, in the schools today, we see so many kids having learning problems and even, you know, Asperger syndrome and even autism. And, you know, we're looking for answers to this, and one of the answers, there's a lot of debate about what causes this, but one of the answers that I think is overlooked is that there's an intolerance which is generated when kids eat artificial colors, because the colors actually have a metabolic effect in inhibiting a very important enzyme in the gut that breaks down a gut toxin, which, if not broken down, becomes neurotoxic. So we have this kind of hidden or difficult to observe cause and effect relationship between food colors and behavior problems, and that would also be an intolerance.
Okay, so when you're testing, or when a science or a lab is testing for an allergy, they're looking at a protein reaction. Is this correct? It's an antibody known as immunoglobulin E,
IgE.
Okay,
yeah, IgE is what they call the reagenic antibody. And it is the one that triggers type 1 allergy, be it to a pollen grain or to crustacean protein.
Or
yeah, and the antibody binds to it, and then we know that it's going to trigger release of histamine from certain cells. When we're looking for an intolerance, as we do with the ALCAT test, or a sensitivity, it's a completely different biological pathway. So we have a completely different approach. And we use a simple blood test to look at the total population of the peripheral immune cells when they're exposed to specific substances. And we use an analyzer that we build to measure the cellular reactions if they occur to the substance. So if we expose a person's blood in a test well to, let's say, extracts from beef or corn or wheat or gluten or celery, and we see that the cells don't respond, then it's a pretty good indication that that person can tolerate those foods. But if we do see a response in the test tube, we usually do see a response clinically.
And the response is what? I guess the layperson look at it like an inflammatory response, or maybe mounting a defense?
It is both. You know, they're related. The immune system, you know, there's a number of different reasons we can have an adverse reaction to a food, and quite often it's because something about the food alerts the immune system that it's a danger to the body. So the immune system attacks it. The result can be release of inflammatory chemicals like histamine, but there are several others as well. The generation of free radicals that can degrade protein and membrane structures and even DNA and has been associated with premature aging and other chemical imbalances. So you can have tissue damages as a result of chronic activation of this part of the immune system, which we call the innate immune system, that can cause metabolic problems, can cause migraine headaches, can certainly cause intestinal problems, skin rashes, respiratory problems, joint achiness, fatigue, neurological problems, and so forth.
So it's just kind of hard to draw all those pathways, though, and know exactly. It's kind of mind-boggling.
It is mind-boggling, and that's why it's been, you know, it's been sort of neglected for quite a long time. Whereas allergy, you know, in the 30s, some experimentation showed that you could take the serum from an allergic patient, transfer the serum into the arm of a non-allergic patient, and then do a skin test there and elicit a response. So the inference was that whatever was causing allergy was in the serum. And then in 67, they identified IgE, as you'd mentioned, and then they created tests for allergen-specific IgE. And if it's present in the blood, it's an indication you have a type 1 allergy. But it's not really until very recently where we did some collaborative research of people at Yale School of Medicine that we found out specific biological pathways that are activated during the ALCAT reactions, which are different, intolerance reactions. And so now I think that there'll be more attention paid to these less acute but actually much more prevalent types of issues that we have as a result of food.
Food-like factors. How hard is it to get this test done? Does a doctor have to order it for you?
Yes, a doctor can order it for you. We also work with a company that has a doctor and a number of healthcare practitioners that provide dietetic advice called Previ Medica. And so there's two ways to go. You can go to your own doctor. You can call our customer service folks and ask them to refer you to a doctor in your area, or you can go directly to the Previ Medica group website or call them and get information about getting tested and then go to a local lab or go to your doctor or have a home phlebotomist come and take your blood and send it to our lab.
This is kind of such new technology. Is insurance covering it?
Sometimes. It depends on the insurance company.
Yeah. It's always depends on your coverage and everything. Yeah, that's always up in the air. But how much does it cost if someone doesn't have insurance or they're not going to go through insurance?
Well, you know, the doctors, each one charges what they feel is appropriate to cover their time and expense for administering the test. If someone goes to Previ Medica, it costs approximately $350 for 100 food analysis, including a month's worth of consultations with a registered dietitian or a dietetic counselor.
So
the price goes up if someone orders more substances.
Yeah, you test up to 450, it sounds like.
Correct, approximately 450, and that includes things that can you know, that we have exposure to. Even functional foods and medicinal herbs can cause a reaction if they're not compatible with our genetic and biochemical makeup. So we test for those things. We test for food additives. We test for mold. A lot of people have serious problems with mold reactivity. That's not always so obvious. Food colorings, as I've mentioned before, mm-hmm. even common anti-inflammatory drugs and antibiotics.
Yeah. We are talking about food sensitivities and intolerance with the CEO of Cell Science Systems in Fort Lauderdale, Roger Deutsch. Do you have a question or a comment? You can give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And as we were mentioning, you test for up to 450 things, including foods, additives, colorings, and chemical substances. I mean, we ingest, I guess, more than food whenever we're having food.
Like, for example, we'll also test for medicinal herbs.
Yeah.
And for those, we'll test for herbs that males usually take and females take, because those herbs can have powerful effects on the body as well.
And then you mentioned earlier a little bit about colorings, and then there are other chemical substances and additives like sulfur. Are you seeing people showing up with allergies specifically to that? Sulfites?
Yes. Sometimes. It's been known for decades that it has an association with asthma. So people can go to a sulfite-free wine or help support the detoxification pathway that detoxifies sulfites, which would be supplemental molybdenum. Those are the kind of things that they would advice they would get based on their specific test results if they consult with a PrevyMedica-trained dietitian.
So when someone has a food sensitivity, the reaction, as you mentioned before, is delayed. It's not an immediate allergic response, and the symptoms are typically more chronic and low-grade. And I'm going to quote from the Mayo Clinic here. It says, it's easy to confuse a food allergy with a much more common reaction known as food intolerance. While bothersome, food intolerance is a less serious condition that does not involve the immune system. Do you feel like sometimes sensitivity has been proven difficult to pin down, so it kind of gets dismissed from the symptom when the symptoms aren't as alarming?
Absolutely. It wasn't, yeah, in the 1920s, there was a presentation given at the Royal Society of Medicine by one of the founders of classical immunotherapy, and he referred to these reactions as toxic idiopathies. And he predicted that they will not create their own field of medicine, but yet they will shed light on lots of the old fields of medicine. So because the immune system, particularly the innate immune system, permeates the entire body, any particular area of the body can be affected by a chronic inflammatory process triggered by foods or food additives or colorings and so on and so forth. But it's not the pulmonologist per se who looks at it. It's not the allergist per se who looks at it. It's not the rheumatologist per se who looks at it, or the neurologist or the dermatologist or the gastroenterologist, because it affects all these different things. And it's almost like in an organization, if everybody's responsible, then no one's responsible. So I think Dr. John Freeman was correct about that. But now we're coming to a point where we're advancing in science so quickly that this area, which has been relegated and kind of has had an attitude towards it, as reflected in the letter you just quoted, as being kind of a nuisance but not necessarily serious, is now being overturned because, A, we know that there are known classical immunological pathways that are getting turned on. This is what's come out last year out of our research from Yale. And B, there's a process called degranulation where these certain types of white cells that contain granules of toxic mediators break down and the entire cell disintegrates and releases its content and causes inflammation and tissue damage, but also causes the release of fragments of DNA, which are now known to cause or can cause autoimmune disease. And that model may help explain why people, even with things like MS, change their diet and avoid wheat and aren't, you know, for example, wheat and three or four other different things, and their MS goes into remission. So I don't agree at all with the statement that it's a nuisance and it's far less important. Yes, if you're having an anaphylactic response, that's more important at that time. But overall, unless you're prone towards that, probably food sensitivity is more important to you.
It's important to the individual, and they deal with it every day. You know, it's almost like something that's hiding in plain sight. As you said, the dermatologist, yeah, the gastroenterologist, all these different specializations might not see something that's right, that's affecting all these things on a small scale.
No, and there's, I think we're in interesting times right now, and things have happened pretty fast, and I'm not sure that our genes have not adjusted to them. And I'm speaking particularly about the commercialization of agriculture over the last few decades, or several decades since the end of World War II, the introduction of synthetic pesticides and fertilizers, and now new techniques for enhancing food crops and desirability of food. It changes it.
Oh, yeah,
and we're not used to these things, and the body reacts to it.
It's been said many times that our food systems have changed more in the last 60 years than they did in the last 6,000. So, yeah. Things have changed definitely a lot, and that's a very quick change.
Absolutely. And then there's another thing which is not necessarily directly related to commercialization, but indirectly, is that, all plants contain natural toxins to protect themselves from pests. And if we grow up as most people did up until, you know, last few centuries, living in the same place as our ancestors lived for millennia and millennia, we developed the enzymes to break down those toxins. But now, when we have plants coming in from all over the place and less nutrients to help our detoxification systems function optimally, some of the toxins that naturally occur in plants can cause a pharmacologically mediated reaction that can cause GI problems, the skin problems, the respiratory problems, and others.
Yeah. We have a phone call coming in from Fort Myers. We have Gary on the line who has a question for you. Gary, what would you like to ask?
As far as the symptoms go, can nasal drip problems be related to food allergy or allergy-type issues? I've had an issue with having to clear my throat because of nasal drip for a long time, tried all kinds of medications, 2 years of allergy shots, and have not gotten very good results.
So you're saying you've had an allergy that kind of seems like it might be one of those environmental things, like you're reacting to pollens, but you're wondering if it might be a more of a food-related thing?
I'm really not sure. That's it.
Okay. All right, so there's a question there from Gary, Roger. He's kind of talking about some things that you normally would dismiss as, you know, a pollen-type allergy, a normal ragweed, hay fever thing. Can that be a food thing?
Absolutely.
So that can
rhinitis, perennial rhinitis. If it's seasonal, if it's only during hay fever or when a certain tree that your skin test positive for, or RAS IgE positive for, and during that season you have the reaction, probably it's that. But if it's around the year, it's probably something that you're exposed to around the year, and very, very, very likely it is food.
It's kind of hard in Florida, though, because everything seems to be blooming all year round. But I guess there are seasonality.
Yeah, there is seasonality, actually.
There's one thing that everybody talks a lot about, gluten. It's gotten a lot of action. People are omitting it, saying that they feel like they're a new person. Are there really that many people who have unrecognized gluten sensitivity that have been walking around until just the last few years?
Yes. We see a lot of gluten reactivity. And gluten is one of those very, very interesting models. Its chemistry is such that it's not really broken down by the digestive system. And therefore, it can cause an immune response. But it can also cause what we call intestinal permeability. And intestinal permeability allows for two things to happen. Well, at least two. The perfusion of not fully digested food substances to go into the blood circulation before they are fully digested. And then they may activate the immune system just by virtue of the fact that they haven't been broken down. But the other thing is it also allows for toxins and microbes that are in the gut that are not supposed to enter into the bloodstream to cross the gut barrier and go in. And so gluten can cause a lot of problems that will be unique to the person. And that's why so many people report that they do feel better when they go, when they avoid gluten.
Well, see, gluten has been part of, you know, our diets for a long time. So is it the gluten that's changed or the people that have changed or just our awareness?
I think it's a combination of all three. I think there's an interesting book that kind of maps out the changes in the cultivation of wheat over the centuries to try and get a higher yield wheat, and it increases the concentration of gluten. I think it also has some effect upon the actual chemistry of the gluten. It's still gluten, but it may have some more carbon bonds, and it's even more difficult to break down. I think we have more challenges. And we have certainly other factors that can cause increased gut permeability, such as stress, for example. We take more antibiotics, and we disturb the balance of microbes in the gut, and we might induce an overgrowth of certain yeast, which will damage factors like IgA antibodies that exclude antigens from the gut. So in that, with that backdrop, then the increased permeability that comes about from having more gluten is more pronounced. And I think we're also eating more gluten, because it's in everything. It's just about in all the prepared foods that we have.
Because pasta is delicious. That is the problem.
Yeah.
We have a question coming in from Kirk in Naples. Kirk, what would you like to ask?
Hi, good afternoon. I've been tested for IgE, and I have a level of well above 10,000. Just recently started on Xolair, my first injection, and I just wondered if the doctor had any experience with Xolair. I've been looking for some relief for some time, and I'm very interested in his test. But looking for feedback on Xolair.
Okay, have you ever heard of anything called Xolair working with people that have food allergies?
Well, I've heard of it. It works. It's a leukotriene blocker, and it's for asthma. And there's some interesting. There is support for use of it in the literature. I should point out, I'm not a medical doctor. I'm a lab guy, and therefore, I really can't give medical advice to anyone.
Yeah. I was going to point that out.
It sounds like it's a properly selected.
Yeah.
Prescribed medication.
So what additives have you been seeing cropping up that are popping up as a sensitive point for people in these testings that you're doing, the blood tests that you're doing, that are kind of a cause for concern?
Well, it's really so unique. Everybody has a unique profile, and that's what I like about this test so much. It's purely individual. It's not based on what your blood type or what you think about this or even what your symptoms are, because both two people can react to something and they manifest symptoms in entirely different ways based on their genetic makeup, based on their biochemistry, and based on their gut microbiome.
Yeah, it might go as like a skin reaction in some people, and then having gastrointestinal problems in another person.
Right. Now commonly there are people who have asthmatics might be more likely to have a sensitivity to sulfite. People with eczema might be more likely to have sensitivities to yellow dyes. But we don't like to guess. We don't like to presuppose. We like to be completely empirical.
Yeah.
And the blood comes in, and we just ask the blood cells what they like and what they don't like.
Yeah, science is great that way.
Speaking.
And that's what it is. Well, we're going to have to leave it there for now, but I do want to thank our guest, Robert Deutsch with Cell Science Systems. I really appreciate your time. And if our listeners have any other questions or are interested in more details, they can check out links on WGCUnews.org to find out more about Cell Science Systems and also about that Alcott test. So thank you so much for your time, Robert.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we check in with Naples' own big ear birder to see how far she's come in her quest to see more than 700 species of birds in 2017. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.